WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been arbitrarily detained by Sweden and the United Kingdom since his arrest in London on 7 December 2010 as a result of the legal action taken against him by both governments. The expert panel called on the Swedish and British authorities to end Mr. Assange's deprivation of liberty. I think the recommendation is quite clear. Respect his physical integrity and freedom of movement, and afford him the right to compensation.
This is Randy Credico. Welcome to 99.5 WBAI here in New York City. And from the West Coast, my co-host for this last edition of the finale of the Julian Assange Countdown to Freedom series. And would you identify yourself, sir? Dennis? All right. Well, I don't have Dennis on the other line right now. He's on. All right.
I'm on.
Okay. I couldn't hear that. All right. Dennis Bernstein from the West Coast. Thank you for being on the show, Dennis. As you know, this is the last episode of the Assange series. Last week, or you were here, and then yesterday was his five-year anniversary of being inside that embassy. And what was your... what went through your head at that point yesterday?
Well, it's just a reminder, Randy, that the U.S. government is willing to go to any length to seal a leak, to undermine the open flow of information. And unfortunately, often it has the full support of the corporate media.
Yes. It's really shocking. I mean, 5 years. 5 years. He's an amazing individual to have been able to do that and continue and maintain this productive work and this important work in spite of all of the pressure that he has and all of the, you know, being separated from his mother and his kids and, you know, just continues to go on. He is a remarkable individual.
I sort of think of him as the global canary in the coal mine of information, and he's singing, and we need to start listening.
Yes. All right. Well, we have a packed show here. We have John Pilger. Our interview with him earlier today, Dennis, will be on at the end without our questions, so we could get everything in. So we'll get reflections from John Pilger after our interview with the great whistleblower, the decorated Air Force and Navy veteran, Thomas Drake, who you met a few weeks back in Washington, D.C. We're going to go to some music here, Dennis, and we'll get back with Thomas Drake on the other side. We'll be right back, folks.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground. Won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby. baby. There ain't no easy way out.
We are back. I'm Randy Credico, Dennis Bernstein from KPFA. I'm Randy Credico here at WBI in New York City. We are now joined by Thomas Drake. Thomas Drake, I just spoke to William Benny. He said that you are a true patriot, someone who cares about the constitutional rights of all citizens, and a great American. We gave an intro before we called. Mr. Drake, I spoke to you today. I really don't want to put you in a box to go through your story, but can you encapsulate your role as a whistleblower?
Well, it's hard to believe that it's been almost 16 years ago now, but my first actual day on the job as a senior executive being hired in from the outside to help keep NSA relevant and meeting the challenges of the 21st century, I was 9/11. And what I didn't know at the time is that Pandora's box would open up in front of me in secret. And what I witnessed was an extraordinary set of strategic decisions that clearly would have enormous impact downstream in the aftermath of the failure of the government to provide for the common defense, as defined in the preamble of the Constitution. That was a failure of 9/11. Almost 3,000 people were murdered that day. And the government at the highest levels, up to and including the President of the United States, primarily engineered by Cheney, but his chief of staff, David Addington, as well as George Tenet and Michael D. Hayden, the then director of NSA, decided that the Constitution was in the way. And they decided that to subvert it. And so I was eyewitness to the subversion of the United States Constitution. I had taken an oath to support and defend it. I was not going to break faith to that oath. And I found myself in the extraordinarily surreal position of having to defend the Constitution that I had taken an oath to support and defend four times in my government career, twice in the military, Air Force, Navy, CIA, and then finally at NSA. I found myself defending the Constitution of the United States of America against my own government. It was not just the wheels had come off, but we were in an entirely different vehicle. It was an alien form of government, but this is all in secret. And so a number of things were done, including authorizing NSA as the executive agent to take its enormous, extraordinary powers of surveillance and turn them on the United States. And that was the mass domestic surveillance program called Speller Wind. I was eyewitness to a number of other things as well. And when you're staring into Pandora's box, the abyss stares back at you. And you're seeing all of these theories escaping in secret. And you have a choice. And I exercise my moral agency and said that I would speak up, and then it was in those days, shortly after 9/11, that I became a whistleblower. And I went through every single channel that existed under statute and law over a number of years, serving as a material witness for multiple investigations, including two 9/11 congressional investigations, a DODIG audit investigation, and I found myself several years later, after having exhausted all channels, knowing that if I went to the press, that I was touching the third rail, that it would be a fateful choice. But I was considering the impact of history, and I decided to make contact with a reporter and gave unclassified information regarding the surveillance programs, the phenomenal multi-billion dollar waste on an incredible scale, and the 9/11 intelligence failures, and as well as other government wrongdoing and malfeasance. And I did that in early 2006, shortly after the New York Times had published an article on the so-called warrantless wiretapping program, which is just the tip of the iceberg.
He may get off.
But it caused an extraordinary response by the government. And as I found out from others, they wanted Cheney in particular, as well as others, wanted to fine and fry whoever had, quote-unquote, leaked that information to the New York Times, which had held on to it at the insistence of the White House for 14 months. In fact, had held on to it from before the 2004 presidential election. And so, long story short, I became a target of that multi-million-dollar criminal, national security criminal investigation. And about a dozen of us were raided, and then those of us at NSA who had spoken up, three of my former colleagues, as well as Diane Rourke from the House Intelligence Committee, we had exercised our own choices in terms of blowing the whistle within channels, got raided in July of 2007. I was subsequently raided. Normally they wait until the final person because they consider whoever they target last to be the perpetrator. And that's when the nightmare began. And I found myself 2.5 years later facing extraordinary charges after having been threatened with spending the rest of my life in prison if I didn't cooperate with the government investigation as a result of my whistleblowing. And the government very publicly charged me with espionage. Under the Espionage Act, the World War I era statute, this is the 100th anniversary of that statute. In April of 2010, and I spent the next 14 months literally having to defend myself inside the court and in the court of public opinion, my own personal freedoms and liberties that the government wanted to take away from me as punishment.
Wow.
But here I am as a free human being speaking to you on your radio show.
That's amazing.
Well, we're glad that you're speaking with us. This is Dennis Bernstein here with Randy in New York City, and it was, I must say, a pleasure to meet you, Thomas Drake, in Washington, D.C., recently at Bob Perry's house, celebrating the great work of Gary Webb. And you were indeed facing a 35-year prison term. They considered you the most dangerous whistleblower since Daniel Ellsberg.
I was the first whistleblower since Ellsberg charged in like manner. It was very extraordinarily rare for an American to be charged espionage for non-spy activities, and yet it became the go-to statute under the Obama administration, not under Bush, but under Obama, although the criminal investigation in which I got caught up was started under the Bush administration. It took Obama to actually indict me with espionage. And I was the first whistleblower since Ellsberg. And, it was the signature. It was the signature Espionage Act case. This was the case prior to Chelsea Manning being arrested. This is prior to Kim and Sterling and Kiriakou and a number of years before Snowden.
And let's talk a little bit about the role of the whistleblower in the context of the journalist. This is, as Randy introduced, the fifth year in captivity, you have to say, of Julian Assange for the work he's been doing through WikiLeaks. Do you want to talk about the significance of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks from your perspective?
I can. I have extraordinary respect for Julian and his associates, as well as WikiLeaks at large, and all of the numerous attorneys representing him personally, as well as WikiLeaks as an organization. He is a media outlet, and above all else, WikiLeaks is on that arc of the universe that does bend toward justice, and speaking truth to power as a media outlet. And also, at the same time, going way beyond what most media organizations ever consider in terms of protecting the source. This is really something that I am quite passionate about, is that the source for any disclosures to the press, and then when it's published, because WikiLeaks is a publisher of record regarding those things that the power elite of the world, including the United States, would rather not have seen by people. And they're doing extraordinary service to the human rights. They're doing extraordinary service, but it certainly ticked off those in power, and power does not yield willingly. And so the ability to, you know, this is scientific journalism, as Julian has described, and, you know, a lot of their releases and publications have been picked up by mainstream media over the years. Particularly, remember when I was indicted in April of 2010, although the collateral murder video, which was a war crime, had already been released, we had yet to see the release of the Iraqi and Afghan war logs, now attributed to Chelsea Manning, showing the extraordinary dark side of American foreign policy and what we were doing overseas. And obviously the government objected to it. Now, I find it interesting that in the 7 years since WikiLeaks has been publishing documents, holding up a mirror for history, you have to remember when those first set of disclosures, starting with the collateral murder video, made such widely noted and reported in the press at the time, and then continuing for a number of months, the federal government had said that it caused enormous damage to national security. Subsequently, in the court martial of Chelsea Manning, that Chelsea Manning would have, you know, the blood of American soldiers on her hands, something they actually said about me, by the way, during my criminal prosecution in the courtroom. And yet, just in the last few hours, thank you, Jason Leopold of BuzzFeed, we now find out that there was a secret under FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, a 107-page report that was prepared by the Department of Defense. And although it's heavily redacted, it was obtained by BuzzFeed News, and it tells a very different story. It actually says that the disclosures that were made by Chelsea Manning were largely insignificant and didn't cause any real harm to U.S. interests. So what was the harm? Apparently, it was the truth about those disclosures that could cause impact in supporting U.S. foreign policy follies overseas, and could be used by, you know, others, and of course the government would claim adversaries, to impact current operations. And I'm so grateful to know, and it is paradoxical for me, but you know, to know that Chelsea Manning is free now. But here's the report. They said the same thing to me, that I caused enormous damage, the highest damage, which is grave damage to the national security of the United States. This national security phrase, it's invoked with great solemnity. It's almost a sacred civic religion of what some refer to, you know, as a national security state or the deep state. And every time you invoke it, it's somehow unassailable. You cannot question it. There's an orthodoxy about it. And there's high priests that protect it of numerous kinds, both, you know, people that are wheeled out to speak about it, people that are brought forward to apologize for it and defend it to the hilt. You know, this is extraordinary power, the kind of power that usually most people cannot handle very well, and it's also ripe for enormous abuse. And WikiLeaks has been at the forefront publishing in the public interest on things that go on behind closed doors with power, and when power abuses itself, it's important to know for history, both contemporary history as well as future history, and as a mirror on the past, what happens. And I just can't emphasize enough. At enormous risk, of course, Julian has endured an extraordinary amount. He had to go through, you know, all kinds of salacious allegations. He was never actually charged. And, you know, now, you know, Sweden has dropped any requests for further questioning. And now it's really in UK-US hands as to what's going to happen. And it's clear that there is a criminal investigation that's been ongoing for quite some time. Even WikiLeaks, just through the Courage Foundation, has actually published a whole series of articles, many of them related to WikiLeaks. It is also documents related to Chelsea Manning, just showing how far the United States is willing to go in an attempt to prosecute those who dare speak truth to or about power.
Again, Dennis Bernstein here. I'm just following up. You did mention how careful Julian Assange has tried to be. We found out last week from his mom that it took him 2 years to create a structure so that he could do his best to protect the people who were feeding him with information. So that is pretty crucial. Could you talk about, I didn't even understand, honestly, the significance of one of his most recent releases dealing with the structural way in which the NSA and U.S. intelligence is working in terms of the equipment. Could you talk about that recent release of his?
When you say the equipment, what are you referring to? I mean, equipment in terms of the CIA Vault 7?
Yes. Yes.
Disclosures. I mean, this, remember, I was eyewitness to the foundational mass surveillance regime. In fact, people don't fully appreciate, even when I flew on RC-135s during the latter years of the Cold War and did electronic warfare when I was in the Air Force during the Cold War, we did not do mass surveillance. It was targeted, and it was only on the things that mattered in terms of keeping track of, you know, foreign or potential adversaries. After 9/11, the mantra was, we just need the data. And it became, we just need to collect it all. How are we going to know it all if we can't collect it all? So the basis for knowing it all was to collect it all. It just became this absolute obsession. And the preference became, and it's in partnership with a number. So the United States became the petri dish, and a lot of this was done in cooperation with U.S. companies that actually manufacture equipment, have access to with extraordinary reach in terms of networks, and the servicing technology, the support networks, both within the United States and as well as overseas. And the decision was made very quickly that we need to simply infect the global grid wherever possible. That's the only way we're going to know or attempt to know everything. Of course, that means we've got to go wherever the data is, and we have to infiltrate and intrude on networks that carry information of all kinds. And in the digital age, this is an extraordinary explosion, far more than what NSA ever had to deal with in the past and during the analog era of the information age. This is now the digital age, and you're just talking, I think, magnitudes more data. And so the decision was, we just need the haystack. It doesn't matter where it comes from. We'll stuff it all in all these barns, and we'll figure it all out later. But the trouble was, and this is the problem with this approach, not only do you bury critical information in the haystack, but you're treating every straw as a needle, which makes it extraordinarily difficult to determine where the needles are, even under a classic understanding of intelligence indications and warning, in terms of how I was brought up even during the Cold War. How do you know what you know, right? And so we just need the data. It didn't matter. And so that mantra extended to offensive cyber operations at the expense of defense. And I think the history, the contemporary history, will amply demonstrate precisely why that was such a fateful decision, because we've seen enormous intrusions, you know, the OPM hack and a number of others where or zero-day exploits, backdoors built into routers and network technology simply to get the data. or distributing payload packages out there that are awaiting to collect even in regional or local networks just because we can. And so that became the mantra, this phenomenal mindset to just take it all wherever possible. And the technology has made it possible that I can stick nowadays barely the size of my fingernail an entire terabyte plus of data, and the cost has come way down. So if you're a nation state or equivalent, effectively the cost of the technology has dropped to zero, which means I now get to store an enormous amount of data, and then I can go back and look at it. And this goes way beyond just classic threats, terrorism, international crimes, money laundering, those types of things. This is the ability behind the scenes to do enormous amount of surveillance on people and society.
This is Randy Craddock.
And that was what I faced. I faced that Pandora's box right after 9/11. And I salute WikiLeaks for continuing to have the courage and the fortitude in the face of literally withering and relentless attacks, both in terms of Julian as a person, to shoot the messenger as a way to avoid dealing with a message or any of the disclosures. And yet they have developed an extraordinary system of scientific journalism that permits the ability to now search because this part of this, they themselves have to deal with how do you make sense of those who have the courage to provide them information that they publish. How do you make sense of it? And they have developed a system and have refined it over the years. This latest batch makes it, as they've done a tribute to making it much easier for those who want to know more about what's going on inside the power structure of the globe, as well as the power centers and government elites and corporate elites, what's going on. Remember, but they do rely on sources, and that is a dependency, and yet protection of the sources becomes critical. It's too easy with the technology that is available by the government. As I well know, I went to extraordinary means. It took me quite a while. How do you actually make contact with a reporter and not get picked up by the mass surveillance system? I was well aware of that when I ultimately made that decision as an anonymous source to go to the press. But when I went, there wasn't a WikiLeaks that I could go to. I actually went to a reporter, a U.S. citizen, for a major regional publication. But I only had one chance to make contact, and that's a story in itself. Knowing that once I did, that the noose eventually would tighten. But I was doing this for history. I was doing this to defend the rights of people and to expose wrongdoing on the part of the government, basically violating the public trust for self-interest.
This is Randy Credico here in New York City. Dennis Bernstein is in Berkeley, California. Thomas, you and I spoke earlier today, and we talked about Julian Assange. Even though he's been in that embassy now for 5 years, under siege, it's like the siege of Montevideo or whatever, he's free in his mind. Can you expand on that, what we were talking about this morning, that he's still...
I can't. This is the silver lining, despite 7 years, right, and 5 years in that embassy. Extremely small space with the most advanced surveillance technology available, targeting that very small embassy. The room they're in, actually, it's a larger building in which the Ecuadorian embassy only takes up a few rooms on one floor. He's free in his mind. I have some sense of that myself during the worst of my ordeal, right, when I was effectively a political prisoner in my own country. But my freedom of movement was quite a bit broader. It wasn't just limited to my house, and I didn't have jewelry on me to keep track of me. They kept track of me other ways. But I had to get permission to leave the local area, and the government had the right of first refusal. He's in a much, much smaller space. And yet, it's allowed him to continue to publish. It's allowed him to continue to speak out. this is, you know, the mind is free. And I am so grateful that there's an extraordinary number of supporters, both named and unnamed, who recognize the historical value of what WikiLeaks is doing for history and continue to provide support for him and his associates. And so, that is the silver lining. It allows you to focus on what really, really matters, especially, you know, given the enormity of what he faces. You know, he was, people forget, I have to remind even your audience, he was granted asylum by Ecuador. That is protected by international law. It is recognized around the globe. It was astonishing that at one point early on, during his initial period in the embassy, that the UK government actually was considering storming the embassy just to extract him. It's astonishing. Violating, sovereign diplomatic territory. You know, there's these agreements are in place and yet they're willing to even violate that. Of course, you know, later we saw how far, and again, I have to thank WikiLeaks, and Sarah Harrison for coming to the defense of Snowden, because Snowden, he knew he had to leave the U.S. He saw what had happened to me and others. And yet he found himself in Hong Kong. But he knew, he said this. He said this a number of times. There was no guarantee that he'd be able to remain free. It was WikiLeaks that actually was able to find a way. And yet the United States saw fit, to cancel, his passport, effectively suspending it, which means he had no proper papers to travel, right? He was not going to Russia, right? He was on his way, to Latin America, South America. We know that from the manifest. We know that from the records. It's another thing that's conveniently overlooked. And so he has, right, I know he would prefer to live somewhere else, but he also has a voice. You know, he lives on the net. He's the older part of the millennials, and they grew up with internet. And so that's where most of his life is spent. And so his voice is not silenced either. It's ironic and fortunate and somewhat paradoxical to state that, you know, I ended up having my passport confiscated, which meant I could not leave my own country, right? He had his passport, you know, suspended, canceled, which meant he couldn't go anywhere. So he was stuck in Russia. And of course, that's been a very convenient narrative for those who have the, you know, sort of this Russian hysteria that's just been so extraordinarily hyperinflated, as I say, that everything is now. Because I think some people, given the complexity of the world and dealing with quote unquote radical, you know, terrorists or terrorism and other ideologies, that some clearly want to go back, sort of the neoliberal, neocon return to the past. Back to the future once delivered, because it makes them much, you know, we could recognize the Russians. But... Thanks.
And, you know, Dennis here again with Randy Credico. Looking at the cover of Time magazine from the days when Daniel Ellsberg did his work, his picture is on the cover, and the title of the cover story there is Battle Over the Right to Know. And this is all about the people's right to know, isn't it? It's the ultimate human right in terms of being able to decide, make decisions about your own life, correct?
Well, some would argue that that's the root of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those extraordinary words in even the United States' Declaration of Independence from one of the, you know, radical elites of the day, right, attributed to Thomas Jefferson. If I don't have the ability to pursue my life, guess what? That's a constraint, you know, on my liberty. And if I don't have liberty, then that's a constraint on my life. And if I don't have life, then what does that become? It doesn't look very good. So the inalienable human rights of all of us, not, you know, it's, we're across, human beings across the entire world, is at stake in this viewpoint that we need to control, we need to manage, we need to have access to the information in a way that allows us to have power over others. And this is sort of the pathology of surveillance. It's the pathology of having, because information is power. And I look at information as power in two ways. Information shared to inform others then empowers you to understand what is going on in the world. And that's across all sectors, all disciplines, you know, all ontologies of knowledge. I mean, just the way knowledge is created and formed and is distributed. But there are those who prefer to use knowledge as power over others. And they take great exception when you expose them wanting to do that, right? Because you're getting in the way. You're getting in the way of interest, self-interest. You're getting in the way of moneyed interest. You're getting in the way of those. And it's pathological. It's a preference for control over others, and it's incredibly addictive. This is an area of study. Some call it psychopathy. This ability to control others is an enormous addictive psychological condition, and it's hard to break. I was well aware of that, having been inside the system, as to how easy it was for people to get caught up in that. And so information is power. It's the coin of the realm. And here's the irony, though. In the information, the digital era of the information age, it's much, much harder to control it.
Randy Credico here. Once again, we only have about 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask you, this is from one of our listeners. What do you think of the technological merger of the NSA, Google, Amazon, and artificial intelligence will look like?
Incredibly concerning. Sort of the understated side of demographic surveillance, which is we can slice and dice you and commoditize you until you don't even know who yourself is, but we get to parse it in a way to sell stuff back to you. At the same time, we have an enormous body of knowledge and information and data about you as a person. Enormous. When you combine those entities that you just mentioned, that just provide enormous power, and the frightful nature of those who would want to abuse it. I mean, I've heard the arguments. Well, you know, if we have reasonable people in positions of power, they're not going to abuse their positions of power, even if they're tempted. Well, what happens when you have someone in power that doesn't care about that, or is less concerned about the rights of others? Well, then that means you're creating an environment which is ripe for enormous abuse.
Dennis, you have another
question? Yeah, and I think, you know, that old phrase, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, we're seeing that in the extreme, and so that's the one side, and you were talking about silver linings. Well, I'm thinking, I heard that some clouds are as tall as 80,000 feet, and that would mean that would be a very large silver lining. And I think about you, Thomas Drake, and I think about Julian Assange, because you are those massive silver linings that we count on. You are our canaries in the electronic coal mine, and you're doing the work that corporate journalists should do, but they've become prosecutors, wouldn't you say?
You know, I remember Ellsberg. I've gotten to know Ellsberg really well, an extraordinary attorney who defended me in the court of public opinion. I can't say enough about her, Justin Radak. She early on recognized what was at stake. She knew this wasn't just an attack and a war on whistleblowers. And truth teller, she recognized that this is now a bullseye on the First Amendment. And you were speaking of the 100-year anniversary of the Espionage Act. It's increasingly clear that in light of what happened to me in terms of the Obama administration's signature case against me, it was also sending a really chilling message to the press that we're on to your sources and we're on to you. And I'm well aware from you know, it's one of the silver linings. I've lost count of how many reporters and journalists I've spoken with over in the intervening years since I was able to hold off the government and remain free. But the attack on the First Amendment, it's really, I mean, this is what I call the de-evolution of democracy and rights around the world. There's this increasing tendency to assert autocratic and authoritarian behavior as a means of control. And that means you've got to control society. And there's, you know, as Margaret Mead said, it doesn't take too many people, right? And so I recognize that one of the silver linings is myself. I've gotten to know Julian. I've gotten to know the extraordinary attorneys that represented WikiLeaks. I had a number of people that came forward, both named and unnamed, that supported me and others. And yeah, we're standing on that moral arc of the universe, and so we're just bouncing up and down on it, you know, just a little bit higher to help bend it. That's all.
Randy Credico here again, and just a couple of minutes we have left, Mr. Drake. I want to talk about your criticism of this documentary that's coming out on Julian by Laura Poitras. You've been critical of the re-editing and the publication of this film that's coming out in a couple of weeks on Showtime. Give us your thoughts on that.
Oh, I've actually seen it. I saw it in a theater, and I was extraordinarily disappointed. I actually expected a lot better of Laura Poitras. I really did. It was just an amazing hit piece. It was an extraordinary, instead of a character, it was a characterization. It was intended as a personal attack. It clearly has lost objectivity. It's now become personal. And she claims, and has claimed in the past, and has done really great work in the past, in terms of what she calls cinema verite. You know, the truth is whatever the camera sees. But when you start manipulating that, I'm well aware that she had enormous access, unprecedented access that no one else has ever had to the networks in which I am a part of, both named and unnamed, right? Both visible and invisible. Both up front in public as well as anonymous. She had extraordinary access to myself, my attorneys, fellow whistleblowers, and including Julian and WikiLeaks. It's just an enormous breach of confidence, an enormous breach of trust, and it's no longer objective. And I it has placed not just Julian but others at risk. And I suspect more than tongue-in-cheek, given that that's the name of the documentary, because he's still under criminal investigation, as well as WikiLeaks at large, including known associates of WikiLeaks. And it's actually reckless for her to have breached agreements that I am aware of. I also know she had enormous access to sort of the foundational context, historical context for all of this, even prior to WikiLeaks, and has simply not provided that in the public interest. She's retained it and has kept it away from those who could benefit greatly from it. And that's also enormously sad to say that.
Well, I guess.
And just in this regard, your thoughts on the carelessness that The Intercept showed in terms of its recent exposure that it let happen to the latest NSA whistleblower.
Well, I consider this is going to be, and I know I'm saying this publicly now, at least on your radio station, there's going to be people that will just go probably bananas for me to say this, but I do consider reality winner whistleblower. But the way in which she was exposed and treated, no matter what else you think of her, no matter what else has been claimed, I am well aware of what the government can do to paint you into a really, really dark corner and manipulate the information and the data to frame you, as I say, frame you in a way that makes you something other than you're not. The Intercept has direct, allegedly, I have to say allegedly, if The Intercept, if she was a source for The Intercept, right, alleged source for The Intercept, they've done enormous damage in terms of source protection. I actually have to think twice when someone comes to me, as many people do, right, behind the scenes and say, where do I go? One, first get a reputable well-known attorney who can represent you and understands what it means to blow the whistle, tell the truth, or quote-unquote leak, as most of the mainstream media likes to put it. It's just a full breakdown in source protection on the number of levels. And unfortunately, I'm aware, this is the other part of the tragedy here, that one of the reporters of record has been known to burn sources in the past, all right, just to get the story. But in this case, they made it pretty easy for the government.
Okay.
Or easier, let's put it that way, easier for the government to determine who the actual source was, allegedly.
I gotta jump in here. We only have. Can you stick around? We interviewed John Pilger earlier today.
Sure.
And that's gonna. Why don't you listen? You want to hang out and listen to
sure.
that? Okay. We're gonna play this interview with John Pilger, and that was done earlier today by me and Dennis.
Well, he's certainly productive, and he's certainly got his wits. I think. Julian is someone who has lived life pretty much to the full. He's a committed and passionate character. He's certainly totally engaged with WikiLeaks and what WikiLeaks means. He believes in the moral mission of WikiLeaks. You don't read much about that in the media, but transparency and really calling to account the forces that like to think they rule over us is what WikiLeaks does, and it's done it spectacularly in recent years. So there is a term, job satisfaction. I think Julian has a great deal of that. And we all know that that can keep us going in extraordinary circumstances. But still, he's a remarkable individual. He keeps his sense of humor, his sense of anger, his sense of justice and injustice. He keeps it on the boil, even though he's confined to one room. Sweden has pulled out. Julian has been, in effect, vindicated. Sweden is no longer part of it. It's gone. The only thing that's really separating Julian and freedom is the very real threat that he could be extradited to the United States and end up in a hellhole similar to the one that Chelsea Manning had to endure. There is, as far as the London police, there is the matter of bail infringement. He did skip bail when he went into the embassy, but that's a minor matter. The real game is what it's always been, and that is the Department of Justice, so-called, getting its hands on him. The revelation of a secret indictment, when in fact Julian and WikiLeaks have broken no laws, constitutionally speaking. Indeed, as Barack Obama, who went on to prosecute more whistleblowers than any other president, as he pointed out, that they are protected by the U.S. Constitution. But that all becomes pretty academic when you have basically political police and a politicized Justice Department out to get you. Empires, when they attack and occupy other countries, although they often set up a system of law, as the Romans did, as the British did, and I suppose as the US did, up to a point in the colonies where it stayed, such as the Philippines and in Latin America. But the U.S. has really behaved lawlessly in the way it has treated the world. That's not an opinion. I think that's a truth. And liberal Americans have always been protected from this rather harsh truth by the notion that they live in a functioning democracy with a system of laws. Well, the empire is coming home. It's coming home from what it's done in the most rapacious way all over the world. It's coming back to the United States, and there are people serving very long sentences in supermax prisons all over the United States who shouldn't be there and who are there because the law has been ignored, distorted, flouted. Not always, of course, not always. But if you take, for example, in 2015, the federal court that examined Julian's the idea of prosecuting Julian, and the judge ruled that the prosecution would remain a state secret, and I paraphrase her, but she said something like she didn't want to upset the executive in the United States. I mean, there's, you know, absurdity always intrudes on these things, but it's very serious purpose. She was saying it's the prosecution, whatever it is, of Julian Assange is a state secret. He can't know. His lawyers can't know, so they can defend themselves, so they can defend him. He can defend himself. The rottenness of empires in all their forms, the subjugation of other peoples, the violence done to other peoples, inevitably comes home. The so-called democratic left, I don't know who they are, and they have no right to call themselves that if they believe that two agencies, two corrupt agencies of political police, one devoted to international subversion and the other devoted to domestic affairs, they've no right to even mention democracy in the same or justice in the same breath. That's why we're almost in a state, in a place of absurdity now. Now, the people you're referring to are so obsessed with Donald Trump, and we all should be obsessed with Donald Trump. What a pity we weren't obsessed with Barack Obama. Going back a little bit, we did get rather obsessed with George W. Bush, and we made fun of him in a mocking way. You know, Donald Trump is a cartoon version of all the ones that went before, a little bit more unpredictable, perhaps. And so they're prepared to side with a totally fact-free, evidence-free, hysterical witch hunt in order to, they hope, see Trump out of office, to see him impeached. That's what that's about. The idea of Mr. Comey standing up and saying, as he said the other day, something out of a bad movie. He said, the Russians are coming for America. Really. I think we won't know where we are, and we don't know where we are, and until we give ourselves what I would call a perception survival kit, until we begin to see the world in terms of the way great power seeks to control it for for purposes of exploitation, strategic advantage, and so on, until we see the world in those terms, we have no way of understanding it. Or we then become rather hapless victims to watching various outrages happen on the news, fires breaking out, as it were, all over the world. We have no way of contextualizing it, of understanding why these things happen. They don't happen as a kind of divine action, divine presence. They are man-made and woman-made. And they are power-made. And until we learn to see the world, learn again. It's only a few years since people did understand that and saw the world in terms of imperial power. Then they could make sense of it. But in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a very successful cultural campaign and political campaign to distract us from that truth, to lead us to concentrate on certain issues in isolation rather than connect those issues with each other and see and then connect them in the on the broader canvas of imperial power. Julian, I think the way people think about the injustice done to Julian Assange and the way they understand the great value of WikiLeaks, of telling us things we have a right to know. But it's this, Julian Assange represents the whole issue that should be at the heart of enlightened society, and that is justice and injustice. And a great injustice has been done to somebody who started an organization devoted to letting us know the things that those who wish to control us didn't want us to know. That's a pretty interesting and, I would suggest, probably noble cause, and it should be supported by people.
All right. Well, folks, thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Dennis Bernstein. I really have to wrap up right now. You guys did a great job today. I want to thank everybody who's been on this show. So many. I was going to name you all, but I can't do it. I'll just say thank you very much, Christine Assange and Julian Assange. Margaret Ratner, thank you for getting me involved in this. It's been a great experience. This series is dedicated to the memory of Michael Ratner and Gavin McFadden. Thank you, everybody. Until next week, I'm Randy Credico and Dennis Bernstein on the other side.
Eyes drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again, don't know where, don't know.
George Orwell's classic novel 1984 was written as a warning. Today, it's used as a playbook.
Do you believe in God, Winston? No. Then what is it, this principle that will defeat us? I don't know. The spirit of man? And do you consider yourself a man? Yes. If you are a man, Winston, you are the last man.
Tune in Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour Pacifica National broadcast of our classic 1975 cover-to-cover marathon reading of 1984 on your Pacifica station. That's Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour marathon broadcast.
And once again, this is WBAI New York 99.5.